Let's talk about great feats of athleticism, folks.
You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm
not. Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a baller. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bowed. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538's sports podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me in the room, the usual crew, Neil Payne, sports writer and editor at 538. Neil, how you doing?
Doing well, Chad. How are you?
Fresh Mets hat on today. Haven't seen that one in the rotation for a while. What? How many Mets hats are in your rotation at this point?
I think I probably got seven.
Seven.
But I mean, so during the season, I kind of, you know, try to ride, as you well know, different hats have different luck elements and must be changed if poor performances are found on the field.
Is that statistically proven?
Oh, of course. Deeply so. I mean, I read about it in a 538 story written by Chadwick Matlin. Chadwick Essinger Matlin.
Wait, what's your middle name?
I have four names. Chadwick Toby.
Toby's
my middle. Technically,
this is far more than you ever wanted.
No,
to
I needed all of this. I needed all of it.
CTEM, the full initials, and that other voice you hear.
Thank God for the M, right? Otherwise, it'd just be CTE.
That'd be chronic traumatic.
It'd be weird.
Whatever. That other voice you hear, listeners, is Kate Fagan, ESPN W columnist and the executive director of Hot Takedown's labor union. Kate,
is it the baseball labor union?
It's Hot Takedown's labor union. You're fighting for the voices of the podcast. It is a reference to the baseball union.
When do we battle with ESPN for higher wages?
Yeah. I mean,
you tell us. You're the executive director. I was hoping you would lead that charge.
Yeah, the CBA is expiring in 3 months. I was just testing your knowledge. But we'll talk after about what you guys want to go for.
Yeah, waiting for
longer
that
bathroom breaks and stuff like that.
I want to be able to buy an eighth hat. So, you know.
All right. So
revenue
definitely.
Share.
20% higher wages.
Yeah.
Don't let that political podcast boss us around anymore.
Hi, Chad. I have to say that.
Thanks for saying hi. Mm-hmm. On today's show, the college football playoff is set, and there is hardly any controversy to discuss. Or is there?
Have not been to Pennsylvania.
We'll discuss whether the committee should care about close calls of the teams that come that make the playoff, and whether Penn State should have been included. Neil, I think, has some thoughts on the matter. Then to basketball, where Russell Westbrook, the Oklahoma City Thunder's, where Russell Westbrook is averaging a triple dubber.
I think that sounds actually better
A triple dubber deeper into the season than anyone since Oscar Robertson. Doing well today. 538's Chris Herring will come by to discuss how Westbrook is doing it and whether it's likely to continue. And then for our third segment, Major League Baseball has a new collective bargaining agreement that Kate orchestrated herself when she wasn't the executive director of our own.
Then I got
union.
This new job,
yeah,
which
that's
was
right.
much higher pay.
Yeah.
And this new agreement may have shifted the balance of power further towards the owners in baseball. We will have baseball writer Joe Sheehan on the show to discuss why he thinks the owners won the deal. And then finally, we asked for your suggestions of a phrase that could replace the eye test, because Kate, you don't like the eye test.
It's a hollow phrase at this point, along with narrative and optics and problematic.
And you want to fill in that hollow space with meaning.
A more colorful phrase that really conjures an image in everyone's mind.
And our listeners emailed many options for that colorful phrase. We will discuss the winner. You know, we'll discuss all of them. We'll pick a winner.
Good.
To stand alongside Grover Cleveland in the Hot Takedown New Phraseology Neologism Hall of Fame.
You know what? If it makes sense, as in if it's not too convoluted and I can remember this new replacement for eye test, I will definitely introduce it the next time I win around the horn.
Excellent.
Ooh.
Excellent.
We should have said
the
that
stakes
before
are high.
We
right
asked
now we might have gotten a few
for
more
input.
People are like, wow.
In fact, now if you think you have a better one, send it for next week, because I won't win around the horn for a couple weeks.
Right.
All right. Let's get to the show. The college football playoff is decided, and the four teams are the four teams that we thought they would be more or less going in, which is Alabama, Clemson, Ohio State, and Washington. Notably, the Big Ten winner is not in that pack. We will note that. And notably, the Pac-12 runner-up is not in the pack either. Sorry. Kate, just real quick, how are you feeling?
I saw it coming really deep down in my gut.
They got smoked.
They got smoked. And did I think that Colorado,
right,
was the, you know, a top five team? No. I mean, like Neil and I were talking before the show. If for some reason they had beaten Washington, like, what would Colorado do against Alabama?
Yeah, getting
I'm not sure they would have made
up
it in even if they had
No,
beaten
I know.
We're,
this is if Colorado. Yeah, I wasn't surprised.
Yeah, it would have been bad.
But the rise is still real. It's just that there's more rising to be risen.
So those four.
It's a rise deferred.
Those four teams are the four teams that 538's college football prediction model predicted. And so the humans on the committee sort of followed what we expected. That did not stop the braying of the lions. Do lions bray? Donkeys bray. The roaring
horses
of
bray.
The lions. Horses bray.
Mewling.
The mewling. Of lions. I think lions just roar. That is the only sound. Doubt in
their cats
state college.
Though.
Pennsylvania. Neil, you wrote on why Penn State didn't really have a case to make. I think we gave them something like a 13% chance to make the top four based on the record coming into the final selection. So, Neil, why should Penn State fans sort of just quiet down and wait for next year?
Well, I mean, one of the big things is, well, there's a lot of reasons. So, first of all, they lost two games. And traditionally, if you look at the way that kind of voters on the AP poll, and we're kind of seeing the committee follow much of the same heuristics when they pick teams. When they organize things, they'll go for the major conference undefeated team. That is your Alabama this season. And then you'll see the major conference one-loss team, or maybe a team from a lesser conference, non-Power 5, that's undefeated. And those two tiers, of which there were, very conveniently for the committee, four teams that came from major conferences, and then you've got Western Michigan kind of off doing their own thing. Those teams traditionally have taken priority over two-loss teams from major conferences. And you can quibble with, you know, strength of schedule, strength of record, all of these things. Most of the metrics favored Ohio State, for one thing, over Penn State. If you look at the power ratings, the football power index, for instance, at ESPN has Ohio State second in the country, Penn State all the way down at 12th in the country, and that's after winning the Big Ten over Wisconsin. So there just wasn't a lot of a case to be made aside from, oh, hey, we beat Ohio State head-to-head.
And won the conference.
We won the conference. But the thing about head-to-head as a tiebreaker is it's kind of a silly tiebreaker, right? If you look at two teams that have the same record, and one of those teams beat the other one head to head, and they played all common opponents, which is true of Ohio State and Penn State because they're in the same division of the Big Ten, then the other team that didn't win head to head had to, by definition, have a better record across a bunch of other teams, you know, to have the
Ooh,
same record
is a
overall.
Smoking hot take, Neil. Very interesting.
So,
but one team's better than the other because we've seen them play each other.
Right. But that by definition means that the
Sometimes
other team
I'm better on some
better
days than another.
Against everyone else that they have played commonly. So you see what I'm saying? It's kind
I see
of
what
circular.
You're saying, but hold on.
what was that?
That was just a guttural yawp.
Brain melting.
Were you brain?
This is interesting, Neil. I've never heard you express this view before. You're arguing that we should judge the quality of a team based more on their record against shared opponents than their record, that the quality of two teams comparatively.
No, I'm not. I'm saying that they should probably have equal weight, or you should kind of take the whole picture of the team. I'm saying that we have traditionally put a lot of privilege on head-to-head, and we've kind of elevated that into a really important position because it is. It's the – well, we can't say eye test. We'll talk about this later. But it is the thing that you've actually seen these two teams play, and so you kind of feel like you have more information about their relative quality next to each other, whereas the other measures feel more abstract, but they're just as real because they involve other games that involve – both teams and the same opponents, and we can account for that statistically. I guess what I'm saying is look at the whole picture and don't constrain yourself to just one head-to-head matchup.
Guys, I'm torn. I'm torn because on one hand, I think college football should just have a scheduling god.
That's what I think. Yeah.
More so to come on that on 538 next week.
Right.
Maybe because we don't sit here and discuss whether like the Cavaliers had an easy schedule this year.
Right.
But on the other hand, I don't think they should have a scheduling god because it is one layer of factor that in the mosaic that is the college football discussion that we just don't have with any other sport. And it the fact that teams can schedule their own opponents is almost like this referendum on their psyche of like do they want to hunt down the tough opponent and face them, or do they want to chalk up wins because they just want to like look good to the committee? Like
it's
just
makes it so much harder to make real judgments.
But that does college football want real
that's
judgments?
What they, no, they want the controversy. I
right.
Think that
I mean,
college football thrives
feeding into their plans right now. I hear what you're saying, Kate, but I.
Do we really want a college football where it's like a computer-generated schedule for every single team? And then also, like, everything – what other factors go into college football? Like, get rid of the conferences. Just make it like a pro league. You're pointing at me.
Next week, Nate Silver is going to come on the show, hopefully, and talk about his grand plan for reorganizing college football scheduling. He has this master plan.
Okay, good. I cannot wait till next week. In the meantime,
yes.
Let's change it in the next week. Says on the College Football Playoff Committee's website that it's going to prioritize conference champions, and it feels like one of those attributes you say is important to you, and until it's like really put to the test, and it was put to the test this year because now it's like, well, how much do you value conference champions if a non-conference champion from that same conference has fewer losses, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Right. But it's important to say that on the selection committee, their first question on their website and their FAQ section of what is the mission of the selection committee, it's to select the best teams. And right. I think that there's – the conference champion can, in many cases, overlap with who the best team is. But in the case of Ohio State, I don't think there's any way you could look at them and, first of all, say that they weren't one of the best four teams in the country. And that's backed up by the polls, the ratings, literally every metric.
Here's the thing, though.
Yeah.
Because Michigan fans would say, well, it was a controversial fourth down call. It was the only reason Ohio State won that double overtime thriller against us. And so my question is, should close calls matter in this election? In this
election.
Because Clemson nearly lost twice, beat North Carolina State in overtime, nearly lost to Troy at home. Ohio State won thanks to that fourth down conversion against Michigan.
Oklahoma State won based on that like extra play that should have never happened earlier in the season against Central Michigan.
Ohio State nearly lost to Michigan State, which is like a three-win team or something like that. So should – and I think this gets at – the larger question we always have about what a win actually means.
To first respond to Neil's point about the first line being that it's, you know, looking for the best teams. Well, within that, automatically, you then want a list of, like, how you're going to define the best teams.
Well, there's
so
a question.
If your number one below is like, we're really valuing conference champions, but then you don't value a conference champion, you still then, I still need a list of how you're defining best. You can't just abstract
but aren't
and be
we,
like, best,
aren't we
but then, do we need to.
To me, the best team, and this is the eternal debate of college football, is there a difference between best team and most deserving team? Because in the case of best team, in my conception of it, it means which team would be, you know, most likely to win in future weeks. You know, if you put which team is intrinsically or at least in terms of the talent they have and the way they're playing right now would win the most going forward. And that's not the same thing as which team is the most accomplished or the most deserving, because I think conference championships play into that idea of most deserving because that's an accomplishment that you can rack up. But it doesn't necessarily mean you are, you know, the best team.
And if you're searching for the best team or most deserving, whatever, you should be wanting as a college football playoff committee or the infrastructure overall to create the system that leads to that answer in the clearest way. Clearly,
because it
we don't
doesn't.
Have that.
And I'm somewhat disappointed by this being the fourth year, right? And there's
– Third year.
Third year? The third year officially of this election?
No, Of this election?
In no year has there been so much – controversy that in the Final Four teams that we could then dive into Chad's question about did these humans in the selection committee actually take into account some sort of in-game situation? Like we won't know whether they care that Michigan might have gotten the bum call.
Well, there was that year with
down.
TCU, right?
Right, 2014, which was the
they
first
went from
year.
Third to sixth.
Such
but...
a bizarre. I don't know that we could actually even learn anything from that
right.
because TCU, for instance, won by 52 points in their last game and was ranked number three going into the final rankings, and then somehow dropped to number six. I just don't. I still don't understand that. And I think maybe that speaks to the biggest complaint about the College Football Playoff Committee is just the total lack of kind of transparency. And to your point, Kate, you know, defining what the best team means maybe a little to argue against myself. You know, there needs to be maybe more just clarity over what teams are aiming for, because I do think based on past years and based on what the committee has said that – you know, you feel like, oh, well, all we have to do is check off this box, the conference championships box, and this, that, and the other. And then there are a lot of teams like Penn State, like Oklahoma, that felt like they did check off those boxes and they still didn't satisfy it. So maybe the answer of being like, be one of the four best teams isn't very constructive.
Yeah, so the moral is just don't worry about what boxes you need to check. Just go live your
just
life.
Just be good.
Right.
Just be
live
good
your life.
At football. Be Alabama, basically. I mean, if we're really being honest.
We're going to leave it there. Real quick, the probabilities going forward of who's going to win is according to ESPN Football Power Index. Alabama, 64% favorite to beat Washington. Ohio State, 55% favorite to beat Clemson. 39% chance overall of Alabama winning the national title. It will be the school's fifth in the last eight seasons under Nick Saban. If the Huskies pull the upset, it will be a coin flip in the final, regardless of who wins, Clemson or OSU. So we will surely talk about that. Stay tuned. Before we keep going with the show, let's get a word from one of our sponsors. Hot Take Down this week is sponsored by Blue Apron, the number one fresh ingredient and recipe delivery service in the country. If you spend a lot of money at restaurants or at high-end grocery stores, you can now spend under $10 per person for a delicious meal that is delivered to you. All the ingredients are delivered to you, pre-packaged, ready to go with Blue Apron. You can cook meals like these: roasted pork and braised cabbage with barley and glazed apples, Thai green coconut curry with sweet potato and jasmine rice, brown butter and chestnut gnocchi with Brussels sprouts, and pea shoot salad. That one sounds pretty good. So the ingredients that Blue Apron sends you are high quality and fresh. They're going to make a real difference in the food that you eat. As I said, it's affordable, less than $10 per person per meal. You get to choose from a variety of new recipes every week or let the team surprise you. The recipes are not repeated within a year, so you're going to get something new. You're never going to get bored. And each meal comes with a step-by-step, easy-to-follow recipe card with pre-portioned ingredients that can be prepared in 40 minutes or less. All you have to do to get all this and your first three meals for free with free shipping is to go to blueapron.com/takedown. That's blueapron.com/takedown. You're going to love how good it feels and tastes to create incredible home-cooked meals with Blue Apron. So do not wait. Go to blueapron.com/takedown. That's Blue Apron, a better way to cook. As we record this on Tuesday, Russell Westbrook has had six straight triple-doubles, not triple-doubles, as I called them earlier this show. And that six number is the average number that all of the NBA had per 100 games last season, what he's done in the last six games, according to analysis by Andrew Flowers at 538. And so this is the kind of thing that is not normal, what we're seeing. And here to talk about it is Chris Herring of 538. Hi, Chris. Welcome back.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate it.
So let me set some of the stats, and then we can jump into how it's happening. So far on the season, Westbrook is averaging 31 points, 10.9 rebounds, and 11.3 assists. He would be the first player ever since, not ever, but the first player since Oscar Robertson to do it, to average a full season with a triple-double if he were to keep this going. It's the deepest in a season that any player has averaged a triple-double so far. So, Chris, let me start with you. How is Westbrook doing it? Like, what are the hallmarks of how he's getting the triple-double?
I mean, he's playing like a man on fire, and I guess anybody could tell you that part of it, but he's I don't know if people really view him. I mean, I think people look at him as a specimen. I don't know that he's viewed as this guy that's totally cerebral with the way he plays the game. But he's doing some things that are a little bit smarter than I think what he's given credit for. Some things you can criticize as well. I think he's really learned how to kind of play officials a little bit to get to the free throw line more. Zach Lowe pointed out in his piece about, I think in the 10 things he likes and doesn't like, that Westbrook is kind of swinging his arm back sometimes to catch defenders that he passes and then are, you know, their momentum takes them into Westbrook as he's shooting a jump shot. And so he's kind of learning how to create contact or at least make it look that way.
But he's also to the foul line and easier points.
Right. So he gets, you know, he hits certain numbers more easily, but he's also kind of limiting some of his shots in certain areas too, where he's traditionally struggled from. I was talking with Kyle Wagner, the sports editor here, and he's shooting 18% from 3 feet to 10 feet this year, which is horrible. I mean, he shot 40% from there last year, but the fact that he's shooting 18% from there and is still hitting these numbers and still shooting the way he is, it actually seems like it might be sort of sustainable at this point.
Okay, confession. I feel like over the last 2 months, as the question Russell Westbrook and the possibility that he finishes the season averaging a triple-double, anytime it's come up, I feel myself sucked back into maybe it's like the gravity of historical context or a viewing of Russell Westbrook in this NBA season through all the other whatever 15, 20 it's been that I've watched in depth. And I immediately say, like, there's no way he can average triple-double. One, because like guards just don't rebound at that pace, and not just guards don't rebound at that pace, but also as an NBA season progresses, like the positioning you have to have on an NBA floor to end up with double-digit rebounds night in and night out, especially when the games, like in that last chunk of 20, which become meaningful, like I can't visualize a guard getting it. Now, but every time I say it, I kind of realize like, I feel like I'm lying a little bit. I feel like I don't really have any sense of how someone could do something like this except through never seeing someone do it. So I don't know if there's a new way to answer the question when somebody asks it.
And what's interesting is that the NBA that Westbrook is doing it in is totally different than the NBA that Robertson did it in. And Westbrook's usage percentage is 41%, but he plays 9 fewer minutes per game than Robertson played during his triple-double season. And so the ball defenses know where the ball is, who's going to finish the possession. We've talked about usage rate on this show in the past, I think in a stat school, the idea being that that's who finishes a possession essentially. And so they know where the ball's headed, and yet he's still at least able to finish on points. And I think the question for me is about fatigue, which is if you're putting this much effort into all sides of play, is that sustainable as much as anything else?
Yeah, I mean, it makes me think of Michael Jordan before he kind of got the talent level around him. Westbrook is kind of the opposite of that, where he had a lot more talent around him, and then now, you know, Kevin Durant has left, and now he is really like a one-man team. But I think it does take a particular situation in which you have a player who's kind of at the top of their game, and they also don't have that many other options for this kind of perfect storm of one person being asked to do so much. Because, I mean, he has to be, I used to have a metric that kind of looked at how many touches a player estimated, I guess, for historical seasons, a player had just the ball in their hands in an attacking position on the court per minute. And I feel like with the numbers that Westbrook has right now, like getting an assist on 59% of teammate buckets, which leads the league, and also taking 41% of the shots plus turnovers that the team has while he's on the floor, that also leads the league. Then also grabbing 17% of the available rebounds on the court, which has to be number one among guards. That's kind of like a forward or center type of number. I mean, I don't think that we have seen a player kind of do everything that a team can kind of ask of one person while they're on the floor. And to your point, Chad, just to go back to Oscar Robertson in 1962, the pace at which the Cincinnati Royals played at that year was 124.9 possessions per 48 minutes. The pace at which the Thunder play at in 2017 is 99 possessions per 48 minutes. So 26% more possessions for a player to be able to do all of those things back in the 1960s. And I should also say that the league now, across the whole league, has its highest pace since 1993. So I don't know if we're seeing like a trend toward more pace, and then the Thunder in particular have upped their pace, and you know, it's kind of that adds to the perfect storm. But it really is, you need to be the only player that's being asked to do a lot of things and also play at a breakneck pace in order to, and play a ton of minutes, obviously, in order to kind of approach a season like this.
I know that we're talking about Russell Westbrook like as a whole, about like the meteoric rise of, well, it's not meteoric, right? But it's just like,
I mean, he was already,
yeah,
arguably, like,
well, with Durant gone, the question was what was going
to
happen.
It seems meteoric because the jump from certain numbers to other numbers in the NBA is something that historically we don't see very often. I know we're talking about it as a whole, but if we really are concerned about the triple-double aspect, it really doesn't matter usage rate totally, because really we're worried about rebounds when it comes to whether or not he's going to be triple double. Yeah, but I mean, he's kind of, if you named one of the three that you're most concerned of, if you think, I don't know if you agree with that, Chris, like rebounds would be the one that I'd be like, that's the one I'm not sure he's going to be able to get.
Because he can't call his own number.
Right.
On the other two, he can call his own number.
Yes, of course. And so for rebounding, that's where I'm like, what is going on? Is it just simply a matter of what positions he's in on the floor? Is it a matter of pace? Is it a matter of like the game itself has changed a little bit? And like, guards aren't getting back in transition on defense, because I feel like they are still. Like, there's a lot of franchises that are like, their guards aren't even necessarily crashing the board. So I'm like, if you just look at the rebounding number, what is changing that's allowing Russell Westbrook right now to do something that we really don't ever see guards do?
Well, I mean, it'll sound crazy, and I'm going to check on it before I make a fool out of myself. the one thing that and no one's going to pay attention to it because he's being asked to do so much already. But the one thing that you have to be careful of if you're Westbrook is, aside from the fatigue, because that, I mean, like you said, we haven't seen it, and so there's always a chance that someone could do it, and then we just haven't seen it done before. The fatigue can obviously play a big role, and you know, how much do you have left in your legs to go up for a rebound or get the positioning that's required? He's always been a top five rebounding guard in the league. He's not necessarily playing his position all that well defensively, and again, that's understandable given all he's asked to do on the offensive side of the ball. But you know, if you're not forcing misses, and their defense has been good this year, he has not been all that great all the time defensively. Sometimes I feel like he's the kind of player that when he buckles down is great on that end of the floor when he's focused, but he also gets pretty lazy, and I understand that. But you know, if there are nights where the other team isn't missing, particularly because Russell's not playing great defense, can you force a miss, and then can you also get that miss defensively and get the numbers that you need to get every night? The other question is, and this happens with baseball a lot of the time too, when guys are approaching certain numbers, if he's approached, and I don't think Westbrook would do this, but do they start to sit him out towards the end of the year to save his body a little bit, assuming that they are going to make the playoffs and that that's a priority, and also assuming that he has already kind of gotten a certain number that he needs for the triple-double? If he's averaging that, do you risk the idea of him playing a game and getting hurt and then having to come out early, and then that hurts his averages?
And the other thing about rebounding, I think in particular, to kind of to your point, Kate, is that like so much of rebounding is also who gets designated on a team to kind of be allowed to grab rebounds that, you know, a number of different teammates could grab, and you just happen to be the player in there. Now, as a guard, it's really difficult to get in the mix in there when you're also, you know, doing all of the other things that Russell Westbrook does. But if you look at the changes to the rest of the team, you know, Kevin Durant was a 12%, you know, rebound percentage guy, and he's been replaced by Andre Robertson, basically, who's now at 8%. You look at Steven Adams, the same, you know, as he was last year. But, you know, Waiters traded for Oladipo. That's not a big increase in rebounding. And Serge Ibaka's gone, and he also was, you know, a pretty good rebounding power forward, and he's been replaced by Sabonis, who also doesn't, you know, 8% rebounding percentage. So if you look down at sort of those decreases, somebody has to kind of grab and make up the difference for a lot of those rebounds, maybe not all of them. And so I think what you're seeing also is that Westbrook is just kind of being designated more as the rebounder just for lack of other rebounders on the court.
Well, and also what it makes me think of, which I think – and this is – it's a good point, Neil, because not just the rebounding efficiency of other teammates, but also any team I've played on, there are certain people where if you're both going for the rebound – like, it's not my rebound.
Yeah,
like,
who a teammate, has priority?
Like, I remember going in and, like, if I saw this person next to me, I was like, oh, she's allowed to get the rebound, not me. And if on this team, I'm not saying it'll account for hundreds and hundreds of rebounds, but if Russell has that designation on this team where it's like, if you're in the vicinity and Russell's in the vicinity, he gets the rebound, you can get one or two, game that way.
Yeah, completely.
So I'd never, like, also factored that in.
So in that case, Kate, I'm sort of thinking about why we don't see other great players on where they're the top dog on the team, like Anthony Davis, for example, find triple doubles. And partly it's because they get the rebounds and the points are easy to come by for a big guy like Anthony Davis, right? And so if you are the best player on your team as a guard, it lets you fill out that harder one to get, which are the assists. And so maybe I'm sort of arguing that to sort of flip or invert your paradigm, which was that the rebounds are the hard thing to get. If you're on a team like Westbrook's, Andrew Westbrook, maybe it's not that hard to get the rebounds because people can sort of cede the floor to you if that's the strategy that you guys are going for.
Right, because if that's the one as a guard, if that's the one where you're like stature-wise and historical and the way the game is play-wise, you're going to struggle to get, but it's almost like a funnel downward for you. Because you're the designated rebound guy, like, I've never really seen that as a guard for a guard before. Mm-hmm. Whereas, like, Anthony Davis, like, you can't put the ball in his hands and, like, make him see the floor, not that he doesn't see the floor, and, like, get him a couple extra assists a game. If as a team you're like, oh, like, let's make sure Anthony Davis gets assists. You can't do that the same way you can do with rebounds.
All right. I think let's leave it there. We'll keep an eye on Westbrook for the rest of the season. I have a feeling that we'll be back talking about this in a few months. That at the minimum, it seems like he'll be hovering around the triple-double mark for a while now. And so this will be a great little subplot to watch as the season unfolds. Chris, thanks as always for coming by.
Thank you for having me.
Last week, the Major League Baseball Players Union and Major League Baseball itself agreed to a new collective bargaining agreement that will lock in baseball for another 5 years without lockout or strike. This is a bargaining agreement that in some ways keeps the shape of the sport pretty similar to what we're used to. The headline for a lot of people was that the All-Star Game will no longer determine home field advantage in the World Series.
I have a lot of questions about that. Okay. I figured that was the most important pressing thing, I'll let you go to other more meaningless.
We can get there. Yeah, exactly. More meaningless, like the whole revenue structure of the major leagues. So one other thing, smokeless tobacco banned for any new incoming players.
There's also a lot of questions there. We can get to these other things that you want to talk about as well.
But then there's some money stuff. And with us to talk about the money stuff, we have baseball writer Joe Sheehan with us. Joe Sheehan writes a baseball newsletter that I've been a subscriber to for a few years now. Joe, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Chad, how you doing, man?
Doing well, thanks. So let me run through just sort of the broad strokes of the money changes, and then I want to sort of get to your thoughts on them. So the luxury tax thresholds are different. I don't think we need to get into the exact numbers, but they are sort of in some ways like keeping up with baseball inflation, essentially, and the thresholds are going to escalate as time goes by. The numbers have changed, whatnot. The international draft, the international player signings is different. There's now a cap on the amount of money that teams can spend on those players, which, and I'd like to get your thoughts on this, may lower the amount of money that players can make because it's not a free market necessarily because there's a cap. And there weren't substantive changes to the way that rookies are paid, basically, or that those rookie contracts happen. And so, Joe, you wrote in your newsletter that this was all looking pretty good for the owners. Is that right?
Yeah, the last few negotiations have ended up with the owners being able to capture a larger and larger share of the game's revenues as those revenues have exploded. And this CBA doesn't change a whole lot. You mentioned the luxury tax. Luxury tax is good. The threshold will go up. It'll go up about $15 million over the life of the deal. That's a very small amount, especially when you consider that it's been fixed for a while now. Essentially, the luxury tax threshold is not keeping pace with the growing revenues of the game. And you look at the difference now between the average payroll and the threshold. You look at the difference between team revenues and the threshold, and you'll find that it's serving as a real barrier to teams investing in their product. It's something that, you know, 3 to 4 teams are hitting most years, and at current pace, you're going to see it be a factor for probably half the league when they make decisions.
Joe, the thing that struck me about the MLB deal, of course, it related it to the NBA deal because I covered their lockout a few years ago, is that, like, in every sport, there's always certain players who are really the ones who are drawing the fans and making the money. And now in say, the NBA, it's like LeBron James can only be paid around about $25 million, even though he's probably worth to any team $100 million. But in the NBA, where that money goes for the most part is to other players, where you've got like mid-level exceptions that are high, rookie scales that are high. You can see that wealth redistributed throughout the players, kind of like a little bit of form of communism. Now, I know that in Major League Baseball, there's a lot of players who do make sky high money, but it doesn't seem to operate in the same way, where you can see that in Major League Baseball, some players are taking a little less than perhaps their like free market value, but it gets redistributed to awesome young players and veterans. Like, where does that money go if that assessment is correct in baseball?
Your local extremely wealthy baseball owner.
That sounds right. Unawesome.
The lack of a payroll floor in MLB is the difference between, you know, MLB and the NBA. As you know, that money, if teams don't spend up to a certain point, that money will get redistributed at the end of the year to the players. So one way or another, players are going to get there. And I don't know exactly what the number is in the deal. It might be 50%, 49%, 51%. It's somewhere in there. But there are mechanisms in place by which the 300-odd NBA players are going to get paid. MLB doesn't have that. MLB has had all of these restrictions on spending, whether it's the luxury tax threshold, whether it's the draft slot, whether it's the international rules, be it the soft slots, the soft cap from previous years, or the hard cap that we'll have in this new CBA. But there's no mechanism in baseball to force teams to spend up to a certain point. And what you have now is, I mean, last year, six teams in the National League went into the season out of 15 knowing they weren't really going to try to win. And this offseason, you've got, you know, probably 5 to 7 teams that are in various stages of rebuilding. Well, in baseball, there's nothing forcing those teams, and, you know, philosophically, I'm not sure there should be, anything forcing those teams to spend more than a certain amount on payroll. So the Padres could spend $30 to $40 million on all of their players next year, while Zach Greinke makes $34 million for pitching for the Diamondbacks. That's just the way the game is. The players have done a poor job of forcing management to take the money they're saving at the top of the market and, as you say, redistribute it through the rest of the industry.
There seems to be, in the NBA, certain lines in the sand. And one of them, at various points, was like, if you were an MVP-caliber young player, you weren't going to sit in a rookie contract. There were incentives, and still are, where, mm-hmm. like, if Anthony Davis had finished, you know, first team All-NBA, or if you were the MVP like Derrick Rose
was. The Derrick Rose rule.
Yeah, like, yeah. There are, yes. Like, that was a line in the sand. Like, if you are a game-changing player, you get paid in the NBA.
But in,
like,
baseball, that's why, where the arbitrage is.
Right, but why don't, like, what do you think the psychology is between those players not drawing a line in the sand? Because we've heard about it over the last few years, like, pitchers and other players sitting at $580,000 a year. Like, at what point does that matter enough?
Clearly not in this negotiation. About a year ago, I wrote a piece talking about how this, because teams have become so much more aware of aging curves and the way players develop and the value of young players relative to older ones, the free agent market has really been whittled down. There have been a couple of effects. One is that teams tend to sign their stars now before they reach free agency, so that weakens the free agent market. And you also have this knowledge that teams have and say, hey, look, we don't need to pay for the experience anymore. We can get the same production from a 23-year-old making $500,000 a year that we can get from a 32-year-old who we're going to have to pay, you know, $7, $8, $9 million a year. Free agency has been chipped away in a number of areas. That's one of the ways in which this money theoretically gets redistributed, but it's not happening because teams, the theory if you're the players is let management have their draft slotting, let management have their hard caps internationally so that they can spend more money on Major League Baseball players. And what's happened is teams won't do that anymore because they know they don't need to. And again, as I said earlier, 5 to 6 teams a year just sitting out free agency because they know they're not going to compete next year. Their window isn't for 2 or 3 years out. So every trend in MLB has worked towards taking money away making it easier to pay Major League Baseball players less.
So, Joe, so you say that, and I understand that, but I still see big contracts being given out to free agents. Yoan Cespedes just got 4 years, $110 million.
Bryce Harper's going to get half a billion.
Well, perhaps, yeah.
If you ask Bryce Harper.
Yeah, exactly, or Scott Boras. So, and Neil, I don't know if you have any numbers on this either. Have we seen that free agent, to Joe's point, that teams are getting wise to the bad deals that signing a 32-year-old free agent might be, you know, to a four-year contract, let's say. Has the amount of money that's been sloshing around in free agency in the offseason gone down relative to the inflation that we'd expect going up? Neil or Joe, I mean, let's start with you, Neil. You're making a face like maybe you have some idea, but Joe, if you have it as well.
I don't know if I have like a great sense for it. I mean, I think of the calculations that people do where they try to, you know, figure out what's the cost of a win above replacement in a given offseason. And those, there's a lot of noise around those, but they do seem to be maybe slowing down in terms of their growth, where you can't kind of assume the same level of kind of year over year annual growth in the cost of a win. But even that is maybe not totally speaking to your point, Chad, because that implies that all teams are kind of operating with the knowledge of, you know, they're operating on this wins above replacement framework, which I think is definitely more true now than ever before, if not, you know, kind of a very good proxy for how teams are looking at things now, which also was part of your point, Joe, right? Like that teams are being savvier, even at the level of maybe if they're spending, you know, more per win above replacement, they're still not throwing money after, you know, big star money after somebody who's not creating a lot of wins above replacement.
Absolutely. It's a 30-team industry, and, you know, you have egos of owners involved. There are a lot of things that could affect any given market. But on balance, you're just not seeing, you know, free agency just isn't the path to acquiring talent that it once was. And it's not the, I mean, you're going to see guys sign for, you know, 4 and 110. But, you know, okay, so that's, I can do math, $27 million a year. Go back. Alex Rodriguez signed his famous contract in 2000, the winter of 2000, 2001. That was $23 million a year. So Zach Greinke now makes, I think he's got the highest AAV at $34 million a year. That's a fairly slow rise for the top of the pay scale for an industry whose revenues have grown fivefold or more in that time. The top of the scale has really flattened out. Manny Ramirez, that same winter, it was 8 and 160, I believe, so $20 million a year. So we hit $20 million 16 years ago. And we're now just crossing over the $30 million barrier. Kate, you mentioned the NBA. The NBA has artificial restrictions in place to keep LeBron James and guys like that from making the $70 million a year that they should be making. MLB doesn't have that, but you've still seen this top of market effect where, you know, you've had the top of the market grow so slowly. And in baseball, you know, going back 40 years of free agency, the top of the market has always driven everybody else upward. And by tamping down the top of the market with the luxury tax, with revenue sharing and the effects it has on marginal revenue product of signing players, with all of that, the top of the market's been tamped down in a way that has cost all players money.
And do you think, Joe, that and you mentioned this a little bit earlier also, that the fact that older players are just not doing as well as they used to, kind of, you know, producing a lower share of the total value of Major League Baseball relative to, say, the steroid era, that maybe that is also playing a role, that just like those players that are now entering their free agent years are less valuable, and so they're getting fewer contracts, and then the players who are most valuable are kind of trapped in this archaic system of team control and arbitration in which their most valuable years are actually getting kind of cut rate prices.
Yeah, Neil can maybe check me on this, but I want to say it was a Fangraphs study 2 years ago that showed that, you know, the typical career path that we, you know, kind of built this whole sabermetric framework on, which was players improve up until about their 20, right around their 27, peak, and then slowly get worse. And after 32, they sharply decline. This study showed that, you know, what players were as good as they were going to be when they entered the league, basically, and for a couple of years after that, and then would decline precipitously. And that has enormous impact on how you would set up a pay structure. And nobody's ever sat down and say, what's the best way to compensate baseball players that makes sense for both the players and management? And this is where the MLBPA, I think, has really fallen down in this last negotiation, recognizing that all of the value is being produced by these 0 to 5 players. When I say 0 to 5, I mean years of experience. They did absolutely nothing in this negotiation to change the compensation of those players. The minimum salary is only going to go up a token amount each year. MLB, the players should have negotiated a higher minimum. They could have gone in and said, we want arbitration to start earlier. They could have asked for earlier free agency. And they did none of those things. And so you're still going to have this case where all of the profit is in the $500,000 players, the Chris Bryants, the guys who are in their first 3 years of a career and they're playing great baseball and they have no path to making more money until they're 3 years into the league.
Yeah, and Joe, as we've written at 538, the youth movement in the league doesn't seem to be stopping anytime soon. There's, as Neil sort of hinted at, there's more value coming out of young players than I think ever before. And our colleague Rob Arthur has written, I think, a piece with the headline "The Kids Are All Right" or something like that. Joe, we have to run, listeners, if you like the kind of stuff that Joe's been saying, definitely subscribe to his newsletter, which you can find a link to on Facebook.com/Sheehan newsletter. Joe, thanks so much for coming on and talking baseball money.
Thanks very much, guys. Take care.
So usually at this point in the show, we bring you our significant digit, a telling number from the world of sports. But instead, we're going to do a little update on something we talked about last week, a new term for the eye test, which Kate Field is a hollow phrase. Let's listen to a little clip of us soliciting the call.
I'm going to need a different phrase than eye test because I just cringe. So let's brainstorm about
that's a different,
a synonymous phrase, but we don't have
territory.
To say the eye test.
Listeners helped us name non-consecutive dynasties way back when.
The Grover Cleveland.
The Cleveland,
yes.
Right?
So can we come up with a different phrase than eye test?
And so what would it be? What does it need to explain? Just like the gut feel once you look at something?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. So as you just heard, we are looking for a new word, a new phrase for the eye test. Kate said at the top of the show she thinks it's outdated, hollow, etc. So rather than do significant digit this week when we bring a telling number from the world of sports, we are instead going to bring a telling phrase, we are going to birth a new telling phrase for the world of sports. You all sent us your emails. We're very appreciative. Are you guys ready to hear what people sent in? I'm just going to offer them to you, and then we can debate pros and cons and then end up with the winner.
Okay.
That work?
Yep.
Okay. Alex proposes the Martian tests. Martian test. Imagine that we meet and can communicate with an intelligent alien species that has eyes. One of the first things we teach them is the sport, say basketball. After understanding the basic rules, would the Martian be able to say that player A was better than player B? So we're moving basically the context of what looks good to the really drilling down to the context of what looks good to the eye is Alex's idea.
Takes a little explaining.
Okay.
Can't really use it conversationally as easily as you want it to. Not totally. I think it's very inventive, mm-hmm. and I like to start with positive things. I forgot that rule.
These are our listeners.
I think it'd be fun if you're having a beer with somebody to discuss it, but to use it and be able to use it without a ton of.
You want a straight faced implementation that we can say on this podcast without like winking or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay.
I agree with what Kate said.
All right, let's move on to Jeremy then. Jeremy writes, "Hi, love the podcast.
Start with a positive.
A former boss of mine used to use the term interocular analysis to make eyeballing something sound more impressive. That to me feels like a little too complex, a little too.
And it seems tongue-in-cheek complex, right? Yeah. I'm hoping.
Always got a chuckle at education research conferences for what it's worth, Jeremy writes.
I want to get a chuckle at educational research conferences.
All right, John.
So that's a no?
Sorry.
That's just
I'm vetoing that.
No.
Sorry, no offense, Jeremy. John writes, change it to visceral view because, quote, everyone loves alliteration. Plus, it speaks to the instinctual gut nature of the phase they pass the eye test. A visceral view sort of.
I like that.
Now, you feel that in you.
Yeah, so would you say, like, according to the visceral view or just, like, in the visceral view?
Well, my visceral view.
My visceral view says.
Yeah, that works.
We got to apply the visceral view.
Yeah. Yeah. I like that.
All right.
Yeah.
All right. Leading candidate.
It might feel a little trying too hard, though.
Yeah. Matt writes, we should rename the eye test to the blink test. This would be a reference to the phenomenon of thin slicing as described by Malcolm Gladwell in the book Blink. Since Blink took a more, quote, scientific approach to gut reactions, it would be fitting for Hot Takedown to use it.
The blink test.
The blink test. Still too testy. I could see that getting hollow.
I didn't read that book.
Okay.
So there needs another layer of explanation.
Yeah,
I want something that doesn't just work with like people in the crew already.
Well, then you ready?
And it's too close to eye test.
Right. They're all eye-based.
All right. One final one for you guys. Okay. Can it be Visceral View? Jacob James tweets at us. New name for eye test. I'm going to start calling it Subjective Quality Index Never Tested, or SQUINT.
Say what it stands for
again. Subjective Quality Index Never Tested. The idea being that the never test is nice. It's the idea being that what we do all the time on this show, right? First, we take what seems to be obvious or not obvious, and on a qualitative basis, and we try to put a number sense.
But this is without that final step,
right? And that's what an eye test is, right? It's before you go to Basketball Reference and whatever else.
I like this a lot.
So Russell,
I'm concerned that explaining it is going to be hard.
So, and the question is, as a grammatical term, would Russell Westbrook,
like
when you squint,
you squint.
With my
right
squint,
now.
Russell Westbrook's squint is off the charts.
Yeah, maybe that's what
I also
it's not
should
a squint.
Say.
Oh, it's a noun. His test is already
test
in.
Test is already in there. It would be a little like automatic ATM
machine. This is very
machine.
Close. We need some tweaks to it, though.
You know,
we need to massage it a little bit.
I will say that squint gets extreme bonus points here at 538 because of our tradition of things like Pacoda and Carmelo, these kind of forced backronyms, I guess they're called. But yes.
All right.
Squint.
I think squint's the provisional leader. Winner once we can figure out the implementation. That's all.
Subjective quality
index
never tested.
That's good. All right. That'll do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan.
Thanks, Chad.
Thanks to Neil Payne.
Thank you, Chad.
Our podcast producer is Katie Ferguson. Our podcast backronym is Jody Avergan. We got production assistance from Tony Chow and Jorge Estrada. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. If you have alternative words that can fill in for squint within the same sort of acronym structure, we'd love to hear it. You can find us on your favorite podcasting app. We're on iTunes as well. Subscribe at iTunes.com/538. Be sure to review and or rate the show. While you're there, it helps others discover the program. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.